Well, I mean, I played the first or second one. Mm. It was like 300 people in the paddock on the back of a truck you played, you know. Mm. It was awesome. And
it hasn't grown that much from there, really. I mean, it's obviously...
Yeah, I mean, they built the stage and all. That's they didn't have pro now, just, but... You were literally on the back of a fucking semi-trailer.
Yeah, amazing.
Welcome to Madman Bonus Features, a new podcast series from Madman Entertainment, giving you an inside look into the making of some of the amazing films from our catalogue, featuring discussions and interviews with the artists and creatives behind them. Firstly, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was produced, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation, and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. In this, our first episode, two legendary musicians sit down to discuss the intricacies of finding themselves at the heart of two different, but equally personal and impactful documentaries. Warren Ellis is a veteran of the Australian music scene. A key member of iconic bands The Dirty Three and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Warren found himself turning to conservation during the pandemic by helping to open a wildlife sanctuary in the forests of Sumatra, as depicted in Justin Kurzel's intimate fly-on-the-wall documentary, Ellis Park. Renowned Aotearoa New Zealand singer-songwriter Marlon Williams took himself on a profound, revealing, and joyful four-year journey of reconnection and self-discovery as he embarked on writing and recording his first album in Te Reo Māori. Ursula Grace Williams' documentary, Marlon Williams, Two Worlds, Ngā Aotearoa, takes us inside Marlon's journey as he connects with his roots and grows as an artist. Listen now to their conversation, recorded at the historic Astor Theatre in Melbourne.
I guess just let us go.
All
right.
Yeah, I've got things I want to know.
Okay.
From you.
All right.
Yeah.
Fuck, I'll tell you if I can.
Okay. Just, it's very interesting that we're... You don't strike me as someone who is fiending to have a film made about yourself.
Not at all.
No.
No, I've always, I mean, I've been involved in a few documentaries, primarily the ones about Nick Cave. There was a documentary made on Dirty Three early this century, I think. But I didn't want to have a film made about me. They've risked becoming like a vanity project, and I don't know, like, it was the same when I wrote a book about a piece of chewing gum I took off Nina Simone's piano, and I was really reluctant to write myself in there because I don't particularly find my life interesting to talk about, and you either blow it up with bullshit and you're so, or you're really kind of humble and like, or you're an asshole. Like, I don't know. I never had any real designs on that. And that was part of the thing. I mean, the documentary on the sanctuary really was about that initially. Mm. I'd met Justin and Bats at Cannes. They were presenting Nitram, and I was presenting a documentary on snow leopards I'd done the music for. And it was after COVID. Justin said, "What have you been up to?" And I said, "Well, you know, I really enjoyed lockdown. It was like the first time I didn't have to do anything, and everything was cancelled, and I didn't feel guilty about doing nothing."
So good.
Yeah, and it was. I realised the world was suffering, but geez, I enjoyed it. At least the first one. The second one was hard work, I found. But then I just started working, you know. Mm. I did a record with Nick called Carnage and a couple of soundtracks and things like that. And I wrote a book and I opened an animal sanctuary. And Justin's like, "What?" And I said, "Well, I opened this animal sanctuary." And he's like, "What's it like?" And I said, "Well, I don't know because I've never been." And he's like, "You've never been?" I went, no, I've been doing it all by WhatsApp and, you know... And I said, "Look, I want to go there. They've been trying to get a piece of I'd sourced a 2 meter tall marble sculpture of the chewing gum in the north of Italy through a New Zealand artist whose name is Frances Upritchard, who works with wool and then casts it in bronze. And she's amazing. And her sister had made the original mould of the gum for me. And she'd sourced me a place to get I hadn't decided it was going to be 2 or 3 metres tall in marble, and I was going to get it on a boat and sail over to Indonesia, which I didn't really know where it was, but I knew there was a river, and take it down on a boat and drag it up onto the hill. And it was like a fuck you to, like, the Musée d'Orsay and the Louvre and that, all these places that me and Anda Mullermister, who made the necklace I wear, because no one was interested, and I don't know why.
Yeah, right.
No one was fucking interested in this piece of chewing gum. And Justin goes, I want to make a movie about
that. God, he would have been eating that up.
And,
that's incredible.
And Bats is like, well, I want to produce it. And I just thought, and I was like, oh, yeah, great, you know. And then a month later, Justin sent me a treatment. And
sorry, what year, when is this?
Well, this is like 2020... one, I guess, okay. 2021, and then they got funding through MIF and other things, I don't know where, and it was on. And then, you know, we had this kind of loose idea that I was going to go over there. Now, all of that, like all great ideas, they never eventuate, you know, like, and for me, that was actually one of the beautiful parts of the process, seeing... making a documentary in this style where, I mean, Justin had ideas. Most of them didn't work. You know, it's just like classic when you're making something. But it's just the kind of the thing that gets you all full tilt at the start, enough to all jump off together. And the process of making the documentary that we made, Alice Park, was very similar to what I felt in the studio, but never been able to articulate it. That sense of just turning up and seeing what happens. But you need something that gets you in there, you know, or at least I do. I need something that gets me in there. And it's usually the imagination of other people or, you know, like... I watched your documentary and you know, it's a very different process. The way you've worked, you spent like 4 years working on the record and that, you know, and for me, it's very different, you know, like I just go in and, you know, like I've never spent longer than, I think, 9 days making a record, which was a double record, Abattoir Blues. But most of them are just like the writing of them. Nick will spend time working. Dirty 3 Records, we'd turn up. Like, and if we could afford 4 days in the studio. You know, like I've always worked like in the moment.
But yeah, because Nick's a daily disciplined writer. You know, the way he's always writing, right?
He seems to be, yeah.
From what I have.
I mean, that's definitely I mean, you know, yeah, he is. He seems to be doing something. It's a bit different now, I think.
I don't really write outside of projects. You know, I'm not someone who writes songs.
No, but I know Nick doesn't just sit writing songs.
Yeah, right.
Like
it's like
he'll go, okay, we need to do a record and sit down, you know.
Sort
like
of he's project focused.
No, he's not. I mean, I don't sit there and just make music for the sake
just
of
for
it,
fun,
you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, luckily I get a film score, I get a couple of months coming in.
There's enough work coming in, yeah.
Yeah, so I just go in there, I don't really know what I'm going to do, and I just have to, I need to have something that I'm working towards. I mean, I very rarely just sit there and kind of, you know...
diddle.
No, I don't. I don't. Like, no, I need to have a reason for doing it. I mean, I always have. And a band gives you that great focus.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it gives you that...
beholden to others and...
Yeah, it's kind of... That's great. I noticed in the film you were looking at a sequence from The Colour of Pomegranates, and I wondered what.
That's from a film called The Rehearsal that I was in, where The Colour of Pomegranates features in that scene in the film.
Ah, so okay.
It's very, very meta. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were using it to get your mojo up or something.
No, I mean, it's a beautiful film, but...
Yeah, it is. I've watched that, if I've watched it 100, it's 200 times.
Well,
I'll just stick it on and...
So pretty, isn't it?
Yeah, I saw that in... when I moved to Paris in 1996 or 7, and I didn't understand any French at all, and it came on the TV... And I couldn't believe what I was watching. I didn't know what it was or anything. And I thought it was just someone had sort of taken a trip or something. I had no idea what it was. And, the next day I was going I saw this fucking film, there's sheep getting slaughtered and there's books flapping in the wind. And someone just goes... Oh, that's The Colour of Pomegranates.
Yeah,
And that sent me on a kind of big... I went and saw all these films on the big screen because in Paris they have lots of cinemas still to this day, which is wonderful, where you can go and watch these films.
Old art house films, yeah.
Yeah, well, just, they're up to sort of 20 people in a room, but... And there was a big retrospective of his on, and I saw most of his films on the big screen, and I saw an exhibition in London of stuff from the props and things like that, Right, so that's in the film.
Yeah. That's just to be honest, that's the only film of was it Pomage? What's his name?
Parajanov. Yeah. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yeah, it's the only one I've seen.
One of my things, I don't have a bucket list, but one of the things I do want to do is go to the museum of his.
He's got a museum?
Yeah, there's a museum. And I have a friend of mine, we're going to go together, but I just don't have time because I've got to feed monkeys. I've got to keep working to feed.
Keep these guys fed.
I've got to keep the monkeys fed.
Have your film watching habits changed over time?
I always watched a lot of film. In the 80s, I moved to Melbourne. Before I delivered newspapers, and then I worked in McDonald's when I was growing up in Ballarat. So I kind of moved to Melbourne when I was 17 to study. But didn't really go to school that much. But whoever was programming the late night movies on Channel 9, I think, I don't know. I mean, I've spoken to Ben Mendelsohn and Noah Taylor, actors, Australian, who said the same thing. The programming back then, whoever was putting on these films, you just sit and... So I saw Minia Moscovich, and I saw, Woman of the Dunes, and I saw Oni Baba. It was just, it's where I discovered Cassavetes, I didn't know anything about it. So I had no cinematic studies at all, but as a kid, I remember going to the cinema seeing The Wizard of Oz and blew my mind, in the cinema. I saw that, and I thought that my mum took us 30 times or something, but actually she took us once.
It was such a thing,
memory. Yeah. And then I remember seeing H.R. Puff and stuff, and then I saw Pink Floyd, that live in Pompeii and stuff. My dad took us to see that because we were too young. Kiss, Attack of the Phantoms. Then I saw The Shining, and I saw a bunch of films, that were coming out, Jaws. Mad Max at the drive-in. That was amazing. Fucking life-changing, Mad Max. I remember seeing Waking Fright on TV, and I remember The Cars at 8 Paris and all this stuff and Picnic at Hanging Rock. And I kind of was... I always liked the fact that cinema took me out of real life, which is the reason that I started playing music was because... My greatest fear, I think, was just falling into a regular job. And I didn't have a safety net in terms of like a family that could support me and things like that. So whatever I did, I had to become. You know, so I worked lots of jobs, cleaning and blah, 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 you know, like did lots of different jobs and worked in kitchens and things like that. And then went to university and, you know, music, well, not music, but, you know, in the mid-80s, you know, when we were all living together, not far from here in these houses, you know, taking drugs and listening to music and things like that.
Yeah.
We all, like, looked up to books, films and music. That's what we all wanted to become. You know, my friend's biggest problem was he couldn't work out whether to write his book in Paris or Rome, you know, like that was his big... Now, he never wrote the book. And, you know, we all looked up to that, you know, and we went to bookshops, and this is in the mid-80s, and, you know, these little section, you know, that you could get, like, books, you know, Bukowski and things like that. You know, I remember when American Psycho came out, and you had to get it in a brown paper bag, you know, because it wasn't... You weren't allowed to put it out on the counter and stuff like that. It was really exciting, you know, and we all... This household we were in, you know, we lived with a drug dealer as well, so we had all these rock and roll people coming through, like Nico and Nick came through, and Johnny Thunders and all this stuff, you know. So they were all coming through, and Nico moved in for a week with my mate, and that was a funny story. And we all kind of looked up to this. None of us had designs on being professional people, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, I never really was in it, you know. I taught for 18 months, but I, you know, I was an alcoholic, heroin addict, and a school teacher.
Hard to be professional.
Huh?
Hard to be a professional.
Well, it's three jobs.
Yeah.
Three professions, you know. So I gave up teaching, and gave up teaching and became a professional alcoholic and drug addict. And then music sort of just kind of happened by accident, not far from here, just literally down there in Chapel Street, and I was staggering across the road, and a car went past and the window rolled down. It was James Boddington, this guy who I'd met. He's like, "Warren, do you still play that violin?" And I said, "I think so, you know, I'm not sure, because, you know, it was just something I'd carried around, I played." And he's like, "Oh, I got a friend with some songs. Do you want to come and have a play?" And it was literally like just down there, like the block from here. And I said, "Yeah, all right." And I went around and we jammed and played a show. And, you know, my brother gave me a distortion pedal and plugged it in the night of the show and just clicked it on and see what would happen. And then, you know, within a very short amount of time, you know, like I'd formed Dirty Three and I'd met Jim White, was playing in the Black Eyed Susans, but it was kind of this like just accidental thing of walking across the road, you know. I mean, I guess I answered it, but it seems like to me that's like making music. You either cut, well, anything creative is like that, you know. You just kind of like, you have to kind of answer the call.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know.
I think, yeah, I having a documentary made about me was not something I ever...
How did you find it?
I found it really difficult. I found it, you know, it wasn't what I expected.
What was difficult?
just squaring with the with the fact that, what you know, it's, even though Ursula was... The director was very much of the mind of showing and not telling, you know.
Whose idea was it?
It was her idea.
Her idea?
Yeah, I met her at a Japanese restaurant because a friend of mine was working on a soundtrack for her. And she asked me what I was doing, and I told her I was going to try and make this record in Māori. And, yeah, I didn't notice that her documentarian ear was listening, you know, was sort of piqued by it until I got an email from her a couple of months later. And she gave me the pitch, and just, yeah, she sort of sold me on the story, and that it was a worthwhile story to tell for reasons outside of me and the, you know, and the album itself.
Right.
So yeah, but the time course, the fact that it took 4 years, because the album took 4 years,
right.
And you know, and the fact that there's always, you know, there's got to be a narrative spun out of things.
Yeah.
You know, and that you're always telling a story, whether you're showing or you know.
Yeah.
There's no pure pure fly on the wall ever. You know, the observer effect is always there, and they want and they want the stuff about the family.
Did you
and
find yourself being pushed into places you didn't want to go?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wanted to tell the story about the fundamentals of making this record, and ended up having to talk about my family and having to, you know.
It sounds very similar to me, like I just wanted to do this thing about the park, and then Justin's like, well, you know, we need to know a bit about, because nobody will know. They're just like, well, who's this guy and what's why?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, beyond the people that know you. And that was really wise, and I'm sure it was wise of the director of your film, because you actually need, you realise what you thought was the idea is like about 10 minutes. Like, and then, I mean, I mean, everything we talked about really didn't happen. Like, it didn't kind of eventuate into anything. It was all the stuff around it that actually became the documentary, you know. But I think I was very much like you. Also, when I was saying when I wrote the book, I didn't want myself in there, you know. And then the editor just said, you know, I really would encourage you to write, because people need a context and they need to, you know. And I, you know, when I watched the documentary, like, I appreciated having stuff about you in there. I totally understand you not wanting it in there, because I guess, you know, you'd like to be private about that stuff too. And like, I mean, who cares, you know, like, it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
yeah, like, exactly. It's it like, feels, you know, sycophantic and...
Yeah, 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 but that's, I guess, part of the deal when you're making a documentary.
I think, yeah, that was the hard thing, was realising that that is the deal, and and not, and
did
it being
you,
too
did
late.
Did you ever want to pull out of it?
yeah, I certainly had, like, stayed up late at night thinking... Just catastrophizing about it, you know, about, you know, we spend so much time myth-making as when we're making art and doing things, and it felt like I was just completely, like, cutting against everything I was trying to do, you know?
Like destroying the mystery or something.
Yeah, right? The same thing, like watching your doco and watching docos in general, of course I want to know exactly what the stuff is that's going on to making this person.
It's very different when it's about you.
Yeah.
Because, when, you know, like, if I'm watching a documentary about somebody, I really want to know about it, and I need context, and I need, you know, I need to have things that I can hang stuff on and understand why it's going on. But it's like making a record, you know, like when you sort of think you've got your couple of key moments in it that are really good, but you need like, things to kind of, like, it's like, I don't know, Justin Kurzel talks about pontoons. And like, he says, you know, like, you need to feel you've got 12, 13 pontoons, and each scene you're swimming to the pontoon and you get to the pontoon, and then everything gravitates together and then it goes apart again. And records feel like that too, you know. Like, I kind of feel like it's a good analogy, like, you... That's where you get your sense of structure of things.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So you need, though, in a documentary about somebody like yourself, you know, you need to have context for people who don't know who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
For the people that do know you, that don't know, you know, anything about you, you know. Mm. But it's very hard when you see, or letting go of that. But Justin was so, like, fucking unbelievable. Like, I knew him not very much at all. And after a couple of days, I mean, he was just, like, the greatest friend.
Yeah.
And the greatest supporter and the greatest... He pushed me really hard, and he said, you know, we don't have to use any of it, but you're at an important moment in your life. I was, like, 58. And he said, you know, I would encourage you to go with this. And it was, you know, I had a fucking camera on me, and and doing a tour, like all this stuff, you know, it's like, but the show's got to go on. You got to do that. And then you kind of get to the end of it. And now I'm so at peace with it, and I'm really glad it's out there. But, you know, it's like when you make a record, when you're making music, the stuff that you kind of get, like you kind of get, and it's not very exciting, but the shit that scares you, the stuff that kind of makes you think, whoa, what am I doing here? Like, or like you feel uneasy, that's where you got to go.
Yeah,
that's where you have to go, you know. You have to feel uneasy. Otherwise, it's like, hey, this song sounds like T-Rex. I mean, who gives a fuck? Yeah. I mean, that's what's great about T-Rex, you know. So
yeah, yeah.
You know, that's like, and I decided to live by what I've how I've lived my musical life with the documentary. Was like, okay, like I have to be as honest as I am in the process, you know.
Was having the documentary there actually a catalyst itself for some of the processing of? I mean, yeah,
it was. It sort of sped. It sort of was like a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
You know, but it just happened. You know, it just happened to be like when the camera was on me, everything just went boom, boom, boom. You know, like 30 years of not living here, and like, you know, just suddenly you get back. You know, like when you go on tour, you sort of meet up with people a year later, and it's like it was yesterday, but it's not, and life's gone on, and all this stuff.
Time gets very odd.
So you know, when you get to 60, if there's like kind of 30. Tours or whatever, you know, like it's like suddenly like shit's built up, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's nothing is as bad once it's in the light as it was when, you know, when I'm staying up at night thinking about, you know, just worrying about, and I was very, you know, I was very lucky in that both of my parents, who are, you know, we've got a very small family, but they were both ultimately very okay with what happened in the film and how. You know, I'd catastrophize some pretty terrible conversations.
What were you catastrophizing about?
Just, you know,
what was your...
Like, Dad and I don't have a very... We're very, very close, but we don't have a... It's not a massively talky, therapeutic relationship, you know? And so it was just, yeah, I felt embarrassed to be talking about trying to do something on his behalf, or, you know, it felt like... I don't know, I felt like I was infantilizing him or something, you know.
In what way?
Just I don't know, I just felt like a little bit like a Hallmark card of oversimplifying. Yeah, it was platitudinous and oversimplifying, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
No, I think just being in a room with other people, watching it, made it easier, you know. It was hard that first time, but then watching it again, knowing that, you know, you're going to get to the end of it, hour 40 or whatever it is, and everything's largely the same, and it's not going to...
But really, like, you know, I mean, I watched it this morning, but, like, there's very little in there about your family. Like, what you're worried about, it's often... what you're worried about is really such a small part of it. Like, it's mainly about you and making the record and that, and there's the stuff that you're talking about being concerned about is... such a small part.
Totally. Yeah. It just grows
but
bigger.
But it's like when you're mixing something, like the bit that you're worried about. No one's ever going to worry about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but you just like labour over it, and then that's all you hear. And
oh, totally. You know, yeah. Yeah, it's just hyper-fixating on...
Yeah, yeah.
On things that feel weirdly resonant or whatever, you know. Then it's, but yeah, no, it's... And now I can watch it with a very sort of very lightly, you know.
I mean, I was so close to shutting it down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was Andrew Dominic. I don't know if you know him. Director. He did Jesse James and Blonde.
Oh, right.
He's from New Zealand, and he did Chopper.
Oh, right, okay.
And Andrew, I've worked on a lot of things with him. I called him because I was having real dilemmas about it, and he's like, you just got to trust Justin.
Yeah.
You got to trust him. He goes, and I would encourage, he goes, go for it, don't hold back. You know, because I could, you know, like you said, where you kind of like were infantilizing things and that. There was a way I could have gone with it where I just sat back. I just avoided all this stuff, you know, and went like, okay. But I think because the way I've approached life and creative life, but life in general, I kind of wanted to go into it as sort of rawly as I do, or as honestly as I do with stuff, you know, and I couldn't sit there and go, well, yeah, you know. that was where the problems come, you know, because I'd been kind of perpetuating this kind of platitudes in my head, you know. And I just decided I'd rip it off, you know. And Andrew was like, you know, you're going to learn something from this, you know. And he'd done the one on Nick when Arthur died. And so I trusted him, you know.
Did he have any power of veto over scenes, over what was being...
I did, yeah. I had some, but...
Did you exercise it?
You know, what I did was I sent it to two people, Nick and Andrew. Andrew, because... I mean, two people I know who cared about me, but Andrew, because he's also a director, you know, so he's not going to go soft touch, like, oh, don't do that. Nick, because his response was... because he was concerned about me. What he suggested not having in there was really different to what Andrew said. And I gave it to my girlfriend to look at, and Jim White from Dirty Three and Mick Turner, like five people who I knew had my best interest. And then I just turned it over to Justin and trusted him, you know, to make the right decisions. And there was a couple of things that I didn't, I said no, and but I just decided to kind of surrender to it, like surrender to it, and like, well, this is his kind of, this is kind of outside of me, you know.
It really feels...
Do you feel better for doing it?
Yeah, I do. It definitely taught me that not to worry so much about many things, I think. It was a lesson in fussing.
Yeah.
You know. And
yeah, it's a kind... I mean, how old are you, 30?
34.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a very confronting thing to do, I think, at that age.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not, yeah, you don't want to tie things up in a bow with this, you know, there's too much, you want to keep things so open-ended and so so possible, so, and it feels, in the same way that making an album sometimes for me feels too conclusive, you know.
Right.
It's like you're choosing endings all the time, where it's nice to have possibilities open.
Right. Well, that's where you make the next record.
Yeah, exactly. And why you feel dissatisfied with the last one, right?
But yeah, I mean, it's just the process of doing stuff. I mean, if you remained satisfied, you wouldn't make something else.
No, yeah.
I mean, I'm still not, you know, I've yet to do... I think when you do your best thing, it's all over. You know?
Yeah, that's a catastrophe.
But it kind of, you know, it is. But then I really believe that. And then... when we finished Ghostine, I just thought, that's it, it's all over. Like,
yeah.
I just thought, you know, we've mixed, did the list final playback, and Nick looked at me and goes, fuck, we did it. And that's all we ever said about it. And I knew what he meant. And I got spooked by that. I just thought, wow, it's the end of our creative thing, yeah. And that had always been my thing. One day I'll do something really good and then it's all over. But,
yeah.
You know, I just spooked myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, I went in and did Blonde and then did Carnage and then did this other... And, it, you know, it goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
You just got to turn up. But, like, you know, it's good to have... This stuff that you're talking... it's only stuff that you can find out for yourself. Doesn't matter, you know, so many people will offer you things about what creativity is all about, and you have some understanding of it. But until you feel it, like love, until you felt love, doesn't, you know, you read about it, you watch films about it, you listen to music about it, and it's somebody else's version of it. But when you feel these things, and it's something I think if you can have a long creative life, then you get a better sense of your own story and context within it. I mean, I was really impressed how you could articulate things in the documentary. You know, when I was your age, I was unable to articulate anything about the process or anything, you know, until quite recently. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed by the way you could articulate, you know, your relationship to it. You know, something really funny struck me in there when you said, oh, I'm 32 and, you know, it's not as easy to go into it. Dude. Like, fucking, pull your pants up, you know? Like, I mean, come on, you know? Like, I mean, like, fuck, it just gets better.
Yeah, I mean, right.
I still do it because I don't like being... I mean, you know, I don't like a lot of the stuff that goes on outside of it, you know? Mm. But, like, when you... I laughed, you know? You said, like, you know, I'm 32 and it's not as easy to tour anymore. And, but, you know, like, fuck, mate, it gets better.
Yeah,
it gets better. Yeah, it gets better. Because I think it gets better.
What changes? What's...
You just realise you're doing the greatest job on the planet.
Yeah.
You realise what a privilege it is to get out there and do this thing that you love, and you realise that it's just the greatest job.
Mm.
You know, and you know, I you know, I mean, like, I've had year, decades where I wasn't in showroom condition, you know, but I just sort of dragged myself around and loved it, you know.
Like, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like, I just always found it hard to fall back into the real
world. That was the hard part.
Yeah, that was the hard part, you know. That, for me, that was the hard part because, and, you know, I mean, I lived in there, that, but then when you start touring, it's just all so different.
Yeah.
You know, and you say that in there, you know, like, there's a thing you say where you, you know, you're exhausted and you got to get up and do your thing. But, my God, that thing, you know, that you get to do that you get, that, you know, it's such a privilege, and to share that with the audience, and that's something that, like, I'm more aware of now, you know, like, coming into, you know, I'm 60 and, you know, I've had, you know, 35 years or something of it that I never thought I'd have. Just feels like the greatest gift and the greatest privilege, you know, to me, that I can still do that. And yeah, I mean, like, fuck.
Did you feel that last night, Marlon? Like, did you feel like it's kind of privileged there, but also like a good gift being able to kind of put the reel on stage, share it in Melbourne?
Yeah, I think having having a very specific external thing that you were trying to do, like, for example, using, yeah, being a space where Te Reo Māori can be, you know, can sit where it might not normally, for whatever reason, have an opportunity to means that it's something very, like, yeah, it's something that's not completely tied up with myself that I feel self-conscious or weird about.
So do you mean like being in a
bigger group of singers?
Yeah, but like, do you mean being in that place, playing in a... I don't understand, like, out of context.
So there's the, you know, there's the feeling of me, if I'm just made an album and I'm playing a show, and there's that thing of like, oh, it's so beautiful to be in communion with an audience. And that's one thing, but it's another thing. It's easier again to have gratitude for what you're doing when it's part of a bigger picture, you know. And obviously, all, you know, you want all art to be part of a bigger picture of things. But I think this the specificity of it being a Te Reo Māori, a Māori language album, and having that, you know, and having people there singing on stage, singing Te Reo Māori on a beautiful big stage in Melbourne,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Has its own external gratification outside of just, it's so nice to play music, you know. So yeah, that's there. But you know, I'd hate to be like living in bad faith by like playing music and not enjoy, you know, and sort of, I guess, again, catastrophizing about, you know, how hard it is and how it's, you know, there's a... Yeah, that was also one of the hard things about watching the doco, was watching me talk in such, yeah, catastrophic terms about how hard touring is when I do really love it, you know. Of course I love it.
Yeah, but you feel that, you know. I mean, have you watched Some Kind of Monster?
Yeah.
Yes. That's awesome, right? You know. Yes. Thank God they put that out.
Yeah. far out. Yeah. How did you go? Here's another question I wanted to ask, because obviously music's such a big part of Alice Park, but you're
music.
Not. Yeah, like the way music's used in the documentary.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Justin had this idea that all the music should be live played. Mm. So everything is just like live played, you know, whether it's acoustic, whether, you know, I'm playing in a church or I'm playing in the jungle or whatever, you know, and then in the studio. So none of it's like added afterwards,
yeah.
Which was a kind of nice idea, you know. It was a bit like the kind of, you know, the Dogma idea with those Lars von Trier films, where they kind of only music could be coming out of the radio or like in the room or whatever,
yeah.
You know. So that, I mean, that was kind of just something, and I'd play, and it sort of evolved and eventually went in the studio and he filmed that and da 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 da.
But you weren't soundtracking it, or you weren't part of the music production of the
I did the soundtrack, but it's all just played. It's all part of the, you know, if you see me sitting there playing in the bottom of a monkey cage.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the mic, you know, that's it. Yeah. And then, you know, it was all, there was no work done additional outside of that and then added to it, you know, which is what you traditionally do.
Oh,
is that it?
Yeah, it's gone quite quickly.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, we're just getting started.
Yeah,
I'm really
enjoying this.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off is going to be playing in here soon.
Oh, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
It's going, but it's going to have some serious
stuff. Really nice to meet you.
It's been really good. Yeah, thank you for watching the doco and
I was really I really enjoyed it. Because you know, you talked about things like this, but I find music the hardest thing for me to keep up with. Like, I watch movies. Mm. I watch movies. Like, that's to me, like, the time I... It's like taking drugs. It's the closest I get to taking drugs and jet lag.
Spend time and, yeah.
Yeah, like, I just love it, you know. And I love watching film and things like that, you know. But music, I kind of have my safety net of things, so it was like kind of great to discover someone new. I wasn't aware of your music and things like that. It was really great to discover someone new. I mean, I find it harder and harder to keep up with everything.
So do I. Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's like understandable.
There's more shit around, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and you kind of have to buffer yourself, but I'm more inclined to go to a movie. Go to a movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did see Iggy Pop though the other day.
Yeah. Right. Great. How was he?
Probably the best I've ever seen him.
Wow.
You know, there's something beautiful about watching. He's 78. Watching people.
78. Fucking.
Yeah,
hell.
And when you're young, you have a different thing on your side.
Mm.
When you're older, like when I saw Nina Simone and when I saw Jerry Lee Lewis and these people who, what defined them, is still in there. Mm. And Iggy Pop was just like, fuck. It was just, you know, I've seen him so many times, but now he's, you know, really struggling, but he was like better than ever.
Wow.
Because he just saw that kind of thing that's made him tick, you know, like... And I find it's like when I saw Chris Knox, you know, at that festival, like...
Just grunting, yeah.
Yeah, like it's in many ways, I find that more inspiring, you know, than... I mean, I saw Lou Reed do Metal Machine music and it was phenomenal. And the sense of him was so strong, you know.
Yeah.
So, Iggy Pop was just like... It was just phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it's exciting watching people that you admire whose art, like, with more constraints, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, fuck, what are they going to do with it? How are they going to do this?
Well, you see what the source is. You see the source and you see why it's held its weight with you for so many years and you haven't gone away from it, you know? And I could see why he pops in the DNA of everything I care about. You know,
yeah,
it's just in there. It's distilled, like, too. Yeah, it's there, like, and... You know, you trace to anyone, Nirvana, like, Nirvana. Like, everyone's channeling this thing because they've all felt this spark from him, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, it was fabulous.
Well, thanks, Warren.
Thanks for listening to Madman Bonus Features. Marlon Williams, Two Worlds, Nao Aotearoa, and Ellis Park are both available to stream now on demand and via DocPlay, as well as available on DVD. You can find where to watch the films via the Madman website. For more information on these films, as well as the others discussed in the episode, please be sure to check out the episode description for links and more details. Madman Bonus Features is produced by Liv McIver and produced and edited by Chris Swan. Additional production support from Ben Clay, Scott Tyler, and Michael Matrenza. Video production by Paul Puccio and DCF Studios. Artwork by Mary Lynn. Please share and subscribe, rate and review, and head over to madman.com.au for information on these films, along with many of the other upcoming exciting releases from Madman Entertainment. And be sure to follow us on social media. Thanks again for listening. This podcast was produced by Madman Entertainment.